Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the years, the anti-sweatshop movement's focus on poor working conditions in footwear and apparel factories has expanded to include electronic sweatshops, most notably Apple and its main supplier Foxconn in China. Following a global backlash over substandard and unsafe working and living conditions, as well as over 17 suicides, Apple agreed to send the Fair Labor Association, a monitoring group, into three of Foxconn's 13 Chinese factories. The FLA's report, which was published just last week, describes extensive overtime violations, safety problems, and managers cheating workers out of wages. The FLA surveyed 35,000 Foxconn workers and interviewed hundreds. The report notes that 43% of workers had experienced or witnessed an accident, 14% did not receive proper compensation for overtime, and also Foxconn has a system in place that keeps workers from being paid for overtime. So on today's Your Call, we're continuing our Agenda for a New Economy series by focusing on these auditing agencies. How do they audit multinational companies accused of substandard labor practices? How are these auditors selected? What kind of leverage do they have? And how independent are they? Scott Nova is executive director of the Workers' Rights Consortium. That's an independent labor rights monitoring organization conducting working conditions in factories around the globe. Their main focus is on the labor practices of factories that make university-related apparel. And Scott joins us from Washington. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by James McMichael, Vice President of Level Works Limited. They're a boutique for-profit monitoring firm. They work with a wide range of multinationals, from the Patagonias of the world to the Walmarts of the world. And Level Works Limited is an accredited Fair Labor Association monitoring group. And James joins us from San Francisco. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose.
So first off, let's talk about the significance of the Fair Labor Association report. They just came out with their findings last week. Scott Nova, what's your overall assessment of the Fair Labor Association?
Of the organization as a whole, or of this particular report?
Of the organization as a whole. And we should say we invited them to come on the show, but they said they've been doing so many interviews that they couldn't join us.
Sure. Well, it's important to understand that the FLA is reflective of a model of labor rights monitoring that is used throughout the global apparel industry and increasingly in electronics and in other sectors. This is a model, essentially, of self-regulation in which corporations either hire or join organizations that they primarily fund and then ask those organizations to monitor conditions in the global supply chains of those same companies. Now, if a company is genuinely committed to improving respect for worker rights, an organization like that can provide assistance. The problem is, since these organizations are funded by the companies they monitor, since they're partly governed by the companies they monitor, their independence is obviously quite limited. So they do not serve as a genuinely independent accountability mechanism, and many companies use organizations like the FLA as a means of trying to pull the wool over the eyes of consumers, to create the appearance that they're attempting to protect the rights of workers in their supply chains without really doing so.
And James, is it true that in January, Apple became a corporate member of the Fair Labor Association?
Yes, that's my understanding.
So what are your thoughts about questions of independence? How can these organizations independently audit a company that's either funding them or that's on their board?
Well, I think that it's a good issue that Scott raises, and I think that the question of full independence is basically accurate as described by Scott. I think the broader question is whether that process is being used by brands and retailers to monitor their supply chains is an effective means of A, identifying problems in the factories in which they source their product, and B, whether that information can be used as a starting point for improving conditions in the supply chain. So I think that there is definitely a place for a fully independent monitoring sort of paradigm, but that's actually not the goal of most of the companies in reaching out to organizations like the FLA or companies like ours to help identify problems in the supply chain.
So what is the goal? Walk us through it, because while this has been going on for a couple decades, it's really now getting a lot of attention because of what's happening in the Foxconn factories.
Well, basically, the process of monitoring a supply chain that a company might take would kind of, it does vary, but there's basically a few different components that it's made up of. First, they need to identify where they're making their product. And a lot of companies out there, back when they first started getting into this monitoring, they didn't even know where their products are being made.
They didn't know where the products were being made?
No, they'd be making, you know, they would think that it was being made by somebody in Hong Kong, but the reality is it was being made in China.
Huh.
So even companies that we start to work with at the beginning, one of the first steps we need to take with them is to help them to identify where is your stuff even being made.
So they were that disconnected from the contractor?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
And then beyond that, there's also an issue of subcontracting that goes on, which is another problem in terms of identifying where stuff is made, especially when a factory or a supplier is trying to hide that from the buyer as well. So there's a few challenges there just to sort of even get going.
And is that still happening today?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so you're starting off by first trying to figure out where the stuff is being made.
Yes,
okay,
exactly.
And then once you find that out, then
yeah.
What
so the companies that have been doing this for a while now, they have a pretty good handle on where it's basically being made. And what they'll do is they'll either identify staff internally that they will train. They'll go to an external for-profit, big quality assurance firm that does testing and other services for them. They might come to a boutique firm like ours. They might go to an NGO that does this type of work. They may go to a multi-stakeholder or an industry initiative that has a team or has a process in place for doing this kind of work on their behalf. So what happens after that is the supplier or the factory is communicated a set of standards or like most companies have, you've heard of codes of conduct, that will be communicated down the supply chain along with expectations that they, as a supplier to that company, will are subject to monitoring of some variety. That could either be unannounced monitoring, it could be announced, it could be sort of a mixed bag of different actions. At that point, the monitoring entity would then go to the factory, either announced or unannounced, and conduct a few different things. First, they would interview the management. They would interview workers hopefully in a confidential manner, either on-site or off-site. They would basically do an audit of the books. What are people being paid? How much are they working? All the components of what the FLA did essentially during their Foxconn audit. And then they would also do a health and safety tour, and they might look at environmental components to it. They might look at security of the factory because of the CTPAT stuff that the U.S. has put out in the past year since 9/11. They might do a variety of different things. Then they'll create a report, send that to the buyer, directly to the buyer, and then the idea is that the buyer will take that report, send it back to the factory, and exert pressure on their supplier or factory to improve the conditions with sort of the veiled threat that if you don't improve over a certain period of time to a certain degree, then we may seek to buy our product from somewhere else. That's the very, very basic sort of structure of it.
So, right. So it sounds like there are so many different ways these organizations do their work. How many monitoring groups are out there currently? Do we know?
Oh, there's probably, there's it's primarily dominated the work by big quality assurance firms like SGS or Intertech or STR or UL.
I've never heard of any of those.
Yeah, they're all the firms out there that basically do the product safety testing for apparel or products that you use every day.
Okay.
And so they have teams around the world and a network of people that when companies started to want to do this type of work, it was an easy kind of fit for them to say, hey, we're already doing quality inspections or testing in these different countries. We know where the suppliers are. We can add this on as an additional add value service to you. And that's kind of how it evolves. So those firms predominantly do, I'd say, 80%. And there's probably six of those big firms, and there's probably another 15 or so boutiques like ours, and then there's another maybe 20 or 30 NGOs around the world that also do this type of work.
And when did these monitoring groups first start doing this kind of work? Because I think about when I first heard about sweatshops, it had to be, I guess, in the late 80s, hearing about Nike and The Gap.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it all started to sort of happen in response to exposés and the consumer pressure that that the companies that, you know, that we bought our products from, you know, had these problems in their supply chain. So in direct response to outcry from the media and the consumers, for sure.
So Scott Nova, James just said that some of these companies, and this still happens today, they don't even know where their stuff is made. That's how disconnected they are from the supply chain. So if we've had these major organizations monitoring multinationals for a couple decades, what's really changed? Because there have been so many reports, a lot of PR, a lot, we hear corporate responsibility now on a regular basis. What's really changed?
Well, by and large, not very much, if we're talking about the apparel industry, where this kind of monitoring has been underway really since the early to mid-1990s. I mean, there have been modest improvements in some areas, but the basic reality for workers in global manufacturing in the developing world of sub-poverty wages, harsh and abusive management practices, lack of basic protections for health and safety, forced and excessive overtime, immediate repression, harsh repression of any attempt by workers to exercise their right to organize a union. These basic realities have not changed, and that's for a very good reason. That is because the apparel brands themselves, the brands and retailers, have not been willing to pay prices to their supplier factories around the world that actually make it possible for those factories to meet the standards that the brands and retailers say they want the companies to meet. In other words, it costs more to produce under good conditions than bad conditions. And the main reason we have not seen meaningful improvements is because even as they officially say that they want their contract factories to clean up their act and improve working conditions, the brands and retailers have not been willing to pay one penny more for the products.
Do you agree with that, James? Not much has changed in the last couple decades?
Yeah, I do. I think that's, that's a colored view, you know, to some degree, but I think it is true. I think that, and it's not just apparel. I think it's consumer products in general. I think that prices, if you look at real prices of products that we pay for, if we look at real wages across, you know, around the world, they, you know, companies look for the lowest cost, manufacturer that can make a certain product at a certain quality level in a certain amount of time. And they chase that all over the world. There's lots of press now about increasing wages in China, and so there's a lot of manufacturing leaving China now. But that's just flowing to other countries like Bangladesh or places where wages are lower. And that doesn't mean that the labor conditions in China have necessarily gotten so good. It's just that they've gotten just a little bit more to where they price themselves out of the market. So I think it's fair that the model of paying as little as you possibly can for a product is true, and it makes it incredibly difficult to get traction in terms of improving labor conditions in a sustainable way on a wide scale. There's definitely examples of companies in a more sort of siloed way to get great improvement and to have success stories for sure, but if you look across the entire landscape, it's complex and it's very difficult too.
And that is James McMichael. He's VP of Level Works Limited. They're a boutique for-profit monitoring firm working with a number of corporations, everybody from the Patagonias of the world to the Walmarts. They're also an accredited Fair Labor Association monitoring group. We're also joined by Scott Nova, Executive Director of the Workers' Rights Consortium, an independent labor rights monitoring organization. Their main focus is on the labor practices of factories that make university-related apparel. And on today's show, we're continuing our agenda for a new economy series by really focusing on how these organizations monitor multinationals that are accused of exploitation and poor labor practices. What is the process involved here? How independent is this? What, if anything, has changed? And sadly, both of our guests said they've been doing this for decades. Nike, The Gap, Kathy Lee, you name it. In fact, on our website today, we've got a number of headlines. Let me just read a few. Student sweatshop simulation draws attention to labor rights violations from In These Times. Labor campaign calls on Olympic brand companies to play fair. Garment workers, the London Olympics. UK feminista, Nike's exploitation of female workers sacked for being pregnant and abused at work. So these are some of the headlines we saw a couple decades ago. So what are your thoughts on this issue? What questions do you have about these organizations that go into factories to monitor what's going on there with workers? The Fair Labor Association is getting a lot of attention now because it is now monitoring Foxconn factories in China. And we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. If you have any connections to this industry, we'd love to hear from you and how it works. And what, at the end of the day, what will make companies change their labor practices? You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or call 866-798-8255. So we will spend time later in the show talking about specifics, but since you both said that not much has really changed over the past few decades, despite so much publicity on a lot of different avenues and companies. Scott Nova, what will it take to really change business practices if these independent and not so independent organizations aren't really doing it?
Right. Well, our experience with major brands in the apparel sector has taught us that brands will move exactly as far on this issue as the public and consumers force them to move. It's important to bear in mind that until the rash of exposés of sweatshop conditions in the early 1990s, none of these global brands or retailers had even the pretense of a labor rights program. They simply ignored the issue. They were getting clothing very cheap by producing it in countries with extremely low wages and no labor rights enforcement, and they were happy to get it cheap. And it wasn't until the exposés created a situation where their brand images were under threat that they suddenly discovered an interest in labor rights issues. And the reality is that, major brands and retailers, regardless of the sector we're talking about, whether it's toys or consumer electronics or apparel, will only improve working conditions in their supply chains if they're convinced that doing that is necessary to protect the image of their brand. And of course, sometimes it is necessary because being associated with sweatshop conditions can be very damaging to the image of a brand. But unless there is substantial pressure from the public and consumers, unless the media is doing its job and focusing attention on the labor rights realities in these factories, a company like Apple, a company like Adidas, a company like Mattel has no real incentive to improve.
What would you say to that, James?
I'd say that, I mean, there's no doubt that pressure from consumers and the media has sparked activity and action in the sector since the beginning, as you mentioned, Kathy Lee Gifford or Disney, or since the very beginning, and it continues. I mean, Apple is a great example of that. That's not to say that I would sort of amend what I said earlier that. You know, in the past 20 or 15 or 20 years, there has been an enormous amount of change and activity in monitoring and trying to improve conditions in the supply chains that's being funded primarily by brands and retailers. I mean, a massive increase.
Right. I mean, and I'd agree, James, with you that there has been a massive increase in the amount of monitoring going on.
Yes.
I just don't think that that's led too much improvement in the real world for workers.
Absolutely, and I would actually agree with that as well. I think that what we're seeing now is that it is an evolution of we've continued to see an evolution of the amount of resources being spent, the amount of critical thought that's going into this process, the amount of organizations that are getting involved to try to experiment with better ways of getting more improvement in a supply chain, either working directly with a brand or retailer or with an industry association or through an NGO or activism. There's, the amount of, when I started doing this type of work about 12 years ago, I mean, the amount of number of articles that came out about this topic, you could count. There weren't very many. I mean, they were there, but they weren't. Now, I just simply can't keep up. There's been a number of organizations and the reports and exposés. It's overwhelming. So I think that a lot of companies are really, really sincerely trying, I think, but there's many, many challenges that they face, and that's not to defend them. But there is a huge disconnect between how companies at the beginning try to source product, where they look for suppliers, how they look for suppliers, how they do costing with their suppliers. There is a huge problem when problems are found at suppliers, whether suppliers want to improve, whether the buyer has or the brand has leverage to get them to improve. And so there's, it's not, you know, all along the sort of path to finding a better model or to improving, there are obstacles and challenges everywhere. So I would say that, you know, if improvement means that there's definitely, it has been improvement if we look at it from a perspective of the amount of time, energy, and resources being put towards trying to get improvement in this area. But everybody fails every day. But,
right. And this is one area, though, I do need to take issue with you, because I don't believe there are many major corporations out there sincerely trying to improve wages and working conditions in their supply chain. I think there are a lot of corporations out there who want the public to believe that's what they're doing. But because really doing that would raise the company's costs and reduce labor flexibility, the companies don't want to actually do it. They just want to create the appearance that they're attempting to address the issue so the public will give them credit for making an effort. Because if they were genuinely attempting to do it, these very large corporations, a company like Nike or Adidas or Apple for that matter, they have the power and the resources to make sure their clothing is made under decent working conditions at decent wages. Nike's been at this for 15 years, and it's very hard for me to believe that a company like Nike with $20 billion a year in revenue doesn't have the resources and the clout to actually make sure its clothing is made responsibly. If they've failed to get there in 15 years, and Nike, among many other companies, has failed to get there, the only rational conclusion you can draw is that they're not really trying.
What are your thoughts on that, James?
Well, I mean, I think there's kind of two camps. I think if you're shooting for the holy grail of that brands and retailers that we buy things have a supply chain that looks like X, then saying that they haven't made it, then that's definitely accurate.
It seems, you know, like, do you think part of the problem here is that there's no, there seems like there's not much accountability, because this group, War on Want, they found that Nike factories are illegally employing staff for more than 60 hours a week. 5 of the 6 factories failed to pay the legal minimum wage. They interviewed women who were fired for being pregnant. They said that they were abused at work. And then ABC News just recently aired an investigation into labor conditions in a garment factory in Bangladesh, where 500 workers died in a fire over the past years. Some exits were locked. The workers had no escape route. They get paid 22 cents an hour, 22 cents an hour, to make clothes for Tommy Hilfiger, Gap, Kohl's, and other American apparel companies. And ABC interviewed Tommy Hilfiger. He said he was pulling out of Bangladesh and then decided he's not going to pull out, but said he would hire an independent fire inspector to take a look at what happened. And ABC reported that they didn't have sprinklers, they didn't have fire escapes, as some workers said it was still common to have padlocks on the exits. I mean, we're still dealing with this 15 years later? Why?
Well, I mean, part of the challenge is that the, I think to Scott's point, if you look at it from, you know, a Tommy Hilfiger or a big brand not having the money and resources to pay more, I think, you know, from their perspective, their suppliers have agreed to provide them a product where these issues don't exist. So from their perspective, these are things that are that their suppliers should be doing just for working with them.
Hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. And
sure.
If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
KALW San Francisco is proud to present Tavis Smiley and Cornel West at the Paramount Theater in downtown Oakland, Saturday, April the 28th at 6 p.m., They'll be talking about their new book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, and the threat that rising poverty poses to our democracy. Smiley and West, Tavis Smiley and Dr. Cornel West at the Paramount Theater, Saturday, April 28th at 6 p.m. It's a free event, but we do ask that you pre-register on our website, and that would be kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about how the year 1968 changed American history. There's an exhibit over at the Oakland Museum highlighting events in 68. Dr. Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy were both assassinated. Richard Nixon was elected. The Apollo 8 orbited the moon. So how did these events change the fabric of our society? And then on Thursday, we will be talking about alternative health and alternative healing practices. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the organizations that monitor multinationals accused of poor labor practices. Just last week, the Fair Labor Association released a report about what they found in three of Foxconn's 13 factories. And Apple products are made there. Most technology products are made there. They found that there were extensive overtime violations, safety problems, and managers cheating workers out of wages. So what are your thoughts on this process? What questions do you have about this? This has been going on for a couple of decades. There are a number of organizations that monitor groups like, or companies that contract out to Nike and Walmart, Patagonia, you name it. And if you work in this field, we'd love to hear from you. And what do you think it would really take to pressure companies to treat employees fairly? And what does that mean? Where do you stand on this issue? I mean, some people say that companies are trying to do the right thing, and some say they're not because they can get away with it. We're talking 22 cents an hour in this factory in Bangladesh, making clothing for Tommy Hilfiger, Gap, and products for Kohl's. 866-798-8255. We're joined by James McMichael, VP of LevelWorks Limited, a boutique for-profit monitoring firm. They work with companies like Patagonia to Walmart. We're also joined by Scott Nova, Executive Director of Workers' Rights Consortium. Their main focus is on the labor practices of factories that make university-related apparel. And let's hear from Kim, calling from Pacifica. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. First of all, I was involved in labor in the first efforts to bring attention to this very issue in the 80s and the 90s. I was a small part of a slate that ran against Hoffa in 98, and I want to congratulate the gentleman that you have on now. And the fact that I'm pretty sure they're younger than I am gives me hope. It gives me a lot of hope. We need to have a lot of young, intelligent people in this field. And what I want to let the public know is that the suicide nets that you hear about for the workers that produce the iPods won't necessarily be a China-only issue until we address this seriously. The free market is all about what Wall Street calls efficiency. Mm. And when you hear politicians say that we must, quote-unquote, compete, be wary. The Wall Street mortgage scandal achieved what absolutely no politician could. It eliminated jobs, it lowered wages here and in what they call old Europe, and it is all about the free market is all about the freedom of labor and goods and services across country borders. And this may sound like pie in the sky, but the old Wobblies had this right. Until we, as a people in this country, come across and join with each other, join hands with each other across cultural, religious, all the different diversities that we have here, we have no chance of changing this. This is marching on, and it's going to affect our kids and our grandkids, and we must do something to address it now. Mm-hmm. The media is not going to put this on. You're not going to see very much about this. This show is so important, and there should be thousands of shows exactly about this. I just want to tell you I'm grateful that you had it on.
Well, thank you so much. And again, ABC News did a really good investigative piece into this factory in Bangladesh. And we've got a number of articles on our website. I mean, if you Google sweatshop, you're going to find a lot of articles. There is pretty decent reporting out there on this issue. So thank you so much for calling, Kim. We've got an email, a listener comment. The Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire was the one that brought about laws to protect factory workers. That was in 1911. But then the fire in Bangladesh happened 100 years later. So does this mean that workers overseas are existing in conditions that are a century behind ours? What are your thoughts on that, Scott?
Oh, that's exactly what it means. You know, in the wake of the Triangle Shirtwaist fire, there was an enormous amount of activism in the United States by unions, by ordinary citizens, ultimately by progressive political leaders that led to a transformation of working conditions in the apparel industry and in American manufacturing more broadly. In fact, it's that transformation that led to the creation of decent middle-class jobs in the United States. And unfortunately, the response of the apparel industry to those improvements over time was to take the work out of the United States and locate it in countries where it was still possible to get away with sub-poverty wages, abusive working conditions, no protections for worker health and safety. You look at a country like Bangladesh, which is currently the cheapest place in the world to produce apparel. Mm-hmm. It's the cheapest place in the world exactly because it has the lowest wages and the least protections for worker health and safety. You'd think a country like that would be a place where brands and retailers that claim they care about worker rights would be very wary of doing business. In fact, the opposite is the case. The brands and retailers are flocking to Bangladesh. There are now 3.5 million workers making apparel in Bangladesh, not because it's a country that protects the rights of workers, but because it's a country that does not.
And, you know, I often hear that from people who think this is going to change or hope it's going to change, is that you've got countries like Bangladesh and China where the U.S. was in 1911. And people say once awareness spreads, once workers realize how much power they have, we will see the same changes we saw after the fire in 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire. Do you agree with that, Scott?
Well, it requires that workers are actually able to exercise their right to organize and advocate on their own behalf. You have seen that to some degree, interestingly enough, in recent years in China, even though independent unionism is banned under the law and repressed by the government, there has been independent worker organizing in defiance of the law by workers in China, and it has led to some improvements. Where workers are able to organize as they were in the United States, you do see real progress over time. The problem is, and the apparel industry is a beautiful illustration of this, it is essentially impossible for most apparel workers in the supply chains of major brands and retailers like Walmart and Adidas and Liz Claiborne and many others, essentially impossible for these workers to exercise the right to organize and advocate on their own behalf. Because as soon as any factory manager identifies a worker who is a leader, who's a critic of factory conditions, that worker is immediately fired, and the rest of the workforce is threatened with dismissal and the closure of the factory. So you've got to have the ability for workers to organize and advocate on their own behalf. That right is supposed to be protected. It's in the code of conduct of every one of these brands and retailers, but they don't really protect that right in their supply chains.
So, James, what happens if you audit a company and say, we've found these violations, overtime, people are working 80-hour weeks, we found that pregnant women are being fired and abused? What happens at that point?
Well, it definitely depends on how severe the issues are that we find. I would back up though and just sort of frame that for the listeners that, you know, when a company hires us, similar to the way they hire a lab to test product to make sure that there's no lead in it so they don't poison their consumers, they're also hiring us because they believe that we have the ability to find out risk issues in their supply chain related to labor. When we are not able to find or identify when workers are being abused or not being paid correctly or et cetera, that's a quality issue in terms of what service we provide to them. And if they're not able to get good service from us and good quality reporting and auditing, they will look somewhere else to do that. So that's one thing that I know that in talking to friends and people that I meet that ask me, you know, you guys are working for the company, that a lot of people don't fully understand is that it's a risk mitigation thing for them primarily, at least at the beginning. So if we can't find it, then there's no point in paying us to do it. But once to answer your question, once an issue is found, it's up to us to raise the flag up to our customer and say, hey, in this factory in El Salvador, they are trying to union bust here, and we need to figure out a plan on what to do. And from our view, we can be there to help support their efforts and give them ideas and be their thought partner on different steps that they could take to help address the issue. I think for when you find really big, nasty issues like that you do have to get the buyer to look at it as a project and say, okay, how are we going to deal with this situation? It's not an email. It's not just sending the report to the factory and saying you got to fix this. It has to be done in a comprehensive manner. And to be fair, most companies, brands and retailers that do a lot of auditing in their supply chain, they either don't have the knowledge or the resources to do it, to follow up on issues the right way, in a comprehensive way, in a sustainable way. And that is another big problem with the sort of auditing or the monitoring paradigm, is that having an audit program, auditing your factories, even if you're doing a good job, is really just identifying where the problems are. It's not, the real work is how do you fix them or how do you avoid them.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call, Kim. And let's go to our next caller, Patrick in San Francisco. Hi, Patrick.
Well, hello. Thanks for having this program.
Sure.
I'm so glad that the media has been proliferating more and more information about this. It's been in the New York Times. It's been on the internet, and now you're doing this, and I really appreciate it. But the first question I have is, how can Tom Helfing or PR folks get away with claiming that they farm out worker protection, when in fact that's just absolute falsehood? And this is just in general, I think that I'll mention that corporations and governments have signed agreements where they agree beforehand to crush any form of labor organizing. Why isn't something done about that? Mm. This just emanates from a laissez-faire, invisible hand, model that at its extreme. And what we need now, and I would like you all to discuss about the need for an international labor laws agreed to by all nations of the world, without which corporations are prohibited from doing business with that country.
Well, and it's a great point, because going back to Tommy Hilfiger, the Gap, Kohl's, where 500 workers died in a factory fire, Actor, one of the labor activists who tried to mobilize workers to demand more protections from the fires, was imprisoned along with her co-workers. Now, she was released because of international pressure, but the government is trying to bring criminal charges against her. So, James, what are your thoughts on this? If their own government imprisons them, does this come down to international pressure?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at we talked about the Triangle Fires, we talked about Chinese Bangladeshi laws, we talk about China, that first element is the laws, is that most countries, I mean, China, using China as an example, they have lots of labor laws. In fact, they have more labor laws than the U.S. does in many of the areas that we're talking about. We don't even have restrictions in the U.S. for overtime hours in a day or a week or a month. China does. A lot of the countries that are that that products being sourced from, they actually have strong laws. What they don't have is the ability to enforce the laws that they have. If the U.S. has maybe one inspector for every 50 places of work, China has one inspector for every 5,000. So when you look at that part of it, that is a huge issue that stands outside of even the way we source product, is that the countries we're in don't even have the capacity to enforce the laws that they have on the books.
Right. Of course, another problem there, though, is that the countries have a very strong incentive not to enforce the laws, because they understand that retailers like Walmart are not in their countries despite the fact that they don't enforce labor laws. They're in their countries because they don't enforce the labor laws. The countries understand that non-enforcement, for example, of the right to organize unions, non-enforcement of the minimum wage, non-enforcement of overtime restrictions, that non-enforcement is what makes production in those countries cheaper and therefore attractive to the brands and retailers. It gets back to a point I made earlier. If the brands and retailers were really serious about protecting the rights of workers in their global supply chains, they would be willing to pay a price for the products that makes it possible for their factories to actually treat workers with respect and still make a profit. But the brands and retailers continue to squeeze the suppliers month after month, year after year, for lower and lower prices. As long as they're doing that, we're not going to see progress. We're not going to see countries enforce their laws. We're not going to see factories respecting the rights of workers. It comes back to the brands and retailers who have the real power in this global manufacturing system.
Because we're talking about multi-million, and in some cases multi-billion-dollar multinationals here, right?
Sure. With Walmart, you're talking about the largest corporation in the world.
Right.
And Walmart certainly has the power to compel its suppliers
to respect the rights of workers. But Walmart doesn't really want that. Walmart wants cheap products. Mm-hmm. And the fact is there is a fundamental contradiction here. You know, brands go to a country like China, a country like Bangladesh, exactly because it's cheap to produce there, and it's cheap to produce there because wages are low and conditions are poor. Then the same companies like Walmart say, oh, we really want to protect the rights of workers. Well, you cannot have it both ways. You can't have the cheapest possible production costs and respect for the rights of workers. But the brands and retailers won't give on production costs. As a result, we don't see progress for workers.
And that is Scott Nova. He's executive director of the Workers' Rights Consortium, an independent labor monitoring organization. Their main focus is on labor practices in factories that make university-related apparel. We're also joined by James McMichael, VP of Levelworks Limited, a boutique for-profit monitoring firm working with companies like Patagonia and Walmart. And now I'd like to introduce Mark Anner. He's an assistant professor of labor studies and employment relations and political science at Penn State. Is that right, Mark?
That's correct.
Okay, sorry, my browser just crashed on me there. Well, thank you so much for joining us. So
my pleasure.
We've been talking about the organizations that monitor multinationals. And earlier in the show, James said in some cases these companies don't even know where their product's made. They both agreed that over the past couple of decades, not much has changed since these groups started monitoring companies like Nike and The Gap. You've been monitoring this for a couple of decades. What is your overall read of the influence these monitoring groups actually have on labor practices?
I think it's been limited. I think one of the issue areas that concerns me the most, the right of workers to form independent unions, to bargain and to strike, is where they've actually performed quite poorly. In some areas, perhaps child labor, forced labor, I think there has been some progress, and I think it's because it is such a potential public relations disaster if that kind of information were to get out. So I think they've taken that issue more seriously. They have something they call zero tolerance policies on that. So that's where I would point to for progress. But for real sustainable solutions to these kinds of issues, I think we need to focus much more carefully on this issue of the workers' rights to organize, to represent themselves, to bargain, and so on. And that's where they've performed quite poorly.
And what do you say to people who claim that this is such a complex issue because you've got contractors and subcontractors, and they can't deal with these issues overnight?
Well, that's a good point. And the problem is the way a lot of this auditing gets done. These are fairly short audits, and I agree. You need someone there that's really going to observe patterns over time and practices and precisely the structure of these short audits. It's not the appropriate way of going about looking at this issue, and that's assuming at the same time that there's really a strong interest in addressing these problems.
Well, can you name a couple corporations that actually have addressed issues based on some of these labor reports?
Well, that's a good question. Based on the labor reports, the evidence we have when we see successes and some of the cases that have been celebrated, the big one I would point to would be Russell Athletic, part of Fruit of the Loom, and so on. So there was reporting being done, but in my view, the solution came about after quite significant student protests, which led to, I think, about 110 universities cutting the contracts, and then we get the solution. So in a sense, reports and the WRC has been very good on this, provide the concrete issues and evidence and so on, and then the activism component, brings on the pressure, and then we get some positive outcomes.
We've got an email from Eva Lynn who says, this will only change when we, the buying public, refuse to buy bargains. There is no free lunch. If you shop by price alone, which most Americans do, the only people making a fair wage are the owners, not the employees. Buy fair trade, look at the labels, stop searching for bargains, and look for fairly made items. Made in the U.S., those items are more expensive because we have the laws that protect the workers. And thank you for that email. And we've got a similar phone call from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I think that an important point is being overlooked here. Mitt Romney said corporations are people. It sounded crazy, but in a certain sense, he was right. The question is which people end up with the profits. Now, if you're a stockholder, however much the corporation is earning, you're only getting perhaps a 4% dividend. And the reason is that as the profits of the corporation go up, people will pay more for the stock so that you end up with a 4% return on your investment, just like you would in any other investment. So although the corporation may be making a tremendous amount of money by abusing the workers, when the corporate profits go down, the value of the stock will go down, and the person's return will go down to 2%, and the value of the stock will go down. So the owners, the managers of the corporation are responsible to the stockholders, and it's the stockholders' interest to keep the profits as high as they can, but the stockholders themselves are generally only getting perhaps a 4% return. I hope that that's clear, but that's what happens with the free market.
Well, and Apple recently announced that it will be distributing dividends because it's got $100 billion in cash on hand. So what about that comment, Professor Anner?
Well, I think this brings up a couple of issues. One is sort of, you know, who's responsible for the situation and for the solution. And I think, you know, you're pointing to the right part of this picture, which is these big corporations and the profits that they have. I understand, you know, the emphasis on consumers, and we should be aware, and we should, you know, understand, we look for bargains, the effect it has. But in this system, I think our power is incredibly limited, and I'm reluctant to put the burden of the solution on individual consumers. I mean, if I had to research every product I was about to buy every time I went shopping on the weekend, it would, you know, I'm an academic, I do research, I could have spent hours just to buy, you know, 20 products. The corporations are the ones that need to take greater responsibility for what's going on in their supply chains, and the corporations have the funds to resolve these problems if they want to. And you know, we're talking about Apple. You know, if I were to be, you know, go by the idea that if it's more expensive, there must be better conditions in the supply chain. Well, those products are really quite expensive, but yet we see all these problems in the supply chain of labor conditions. So I think the real problem comes down to that power relationship between these major corporations and their suppliers, and how that allows them to squeeze the suppliers, which turn around and then squeeze the workforce.
So what do you expect will come from the FLA report? Because a Fox FLA representative was on the NewsHour recently, and he said that the FLA will continue to monitor these commitments. They'll be sending their assessors back to update and verify the status. And he said they believe that Apple will take measures to change things because there's been so much public pressure. Do you believe that we'll see changes?
Well, let me point to one you know, question in the report. So, you know, there's an assumption that the recommendations are very good, and now the question is implementation, and that's partly true. But for me, some of the recommendations miss the mark. So again, where I focus my interest is on labor and labor unions and their ability to bargain and so on. So one of the big observations in the research, and one of the conclusions in the report, is that most workers don't know that the union exists, and they haven't seen the collective bargaining agreement. Mm-hmm. And so the solution is they'll make copies of the collective bargaining agreement and distribute it to the 288,000 workers, and this will be monitored, and there'll be follow-up to make sure everyone has a copy of the collective bargaining agreement. If you read the report carefully, we actually have no idea what's in that collective bargaining agreement. What we do know is that the majority of union leaders at the Foxconn union come from management. The report says that very clearly. And actually, the workers thought there was more union representation, but when they did the research, that was their perception. The research shows that the majority of leaders in the union come from management. So then the question is, what kind of collective bargaining agreement do you get when management is, in a sense, really just, you know, drafting this I wouldn't call it a collective bargaining agreement, some sort of statement of what they think they're going to do. And you know, we see situations in a lot of these countries where when you actually look at the agreements, they have what we call neutral clauses. They repeat what's already in the labor law. So, with all these different problems of overtime and wages, were there any violations of the collective bargaining agreement? Did it actually mean anything? Could, when a union that's controlled by management, can you actually expect anything out of the collective bargaining agreement? So that's a very large problem. I don't think the solution is making photocopies of the existing collective bargaining agreement and distributing it to the workforce.
Hmm.
And I'll mention one other point, which gets to an even thornier issue, which is the right to strike. So the research done in the report finds that there was it was in the employee handbook. It said that you would be fired if you participated in an illegal strike. Well, you know, all strikes are considered illegal in China. So that, you know, you just said you would be fired if you participated in a strike. So the solution to it that's being proposed is that language should be removed from the handbook. Okay, that's fine to do, but it doesn't change the context in the country. That's still in China. You're not allowed to go on strike. And these things fit together. If it's, and you know, again, coming from an employment relations perspective, it's not, you know, the right to strike that you should be out striking every day. In employment relations, the way we look at it, it's the threat of a strike that matters, because that's what pushes real bargaining along. So the vast majority of collective bargaining agreements in the world take place without strikes. But the
Professor,
we're almost
out of time. It sounds like we really need to do another show about workers' rights overseas and what rights do they actually have. And just a quick final thoughts from you, James McMichael.
Well, I think it's important for the listeners to understand that when you look at Foxconn, you know, if you look at the report and all the information that was generated in the report, which most of it seems, completely in line with my understanding of what factory conditions are in China. Actually, that Foxconn, those conditions are actually, you know, leaps and bounds better than most of the factories that we visit in China, in terms of working hours, in terms of wages, in terms almost across the board. So as shocking as those may be, that's actually relatively good.
And Scott Nova, final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I must say I disagree with that. I think the conditions at Foxconn, as revealed not just by the FLA report, but by more independent investigations, are atrocious. Long hours of excessive overtime, grievous health and safety threats resulting in worker deaths and injuries last year. You've got extremely poor conditions. And I think one of the problems here is our expectations of these companies are far too low. Mm. You know, the FLA has recommended that Apple and Foxconn should stop violating overtime laws by the middle of 2013.
And we're out of time. We're going to have to continue this conversation.
Sure.
Sorry to cut you off. That is Scott Nova. We've also been joined by James McMichael and Mark Anner. Thank you all for joining us. And thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How did the year 1968 change American history? On the next Jour Call, we'll talk about an Oakland Museum exhibit highlighting events in 68. Dr. Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy were both assassinated. Richard Nixon was elected. And Apollo 8 orbited the moon. How did these events change the fabric of our society? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What can we learn today from the victories and the setbacks of 1968? It's Jour Call with Holly Kernan and you.